Welcome back to the third hour of Issues Etc. Let me begin by apologizing to the people we had to leave hanging on the line there at the end of that open lines. This just inevitably happens. We're not going to be able to get to everybody, and I do apologize for those of you who are waiting, and I did not get to you during open lines. The conversation, of course, will continue during open lines tomorrow, if that's what's in the cards for us there, Lord willing. Mixing my metaphors, cards and the Lord. Go figure. Helen Holt Hitchcock joins us here in the last hour of the program for the first half to talk about the installation of St. Louis Archbishop Raymond Burke. He's been in the news here in St. Louis, probably given more space, print space, in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in the weeks running up to and the day of his installation than Archbishop Justin Regali received in probably the first year or two of his time as Archbishop. The reasons for that we've been talking about here on Issues Etc. has to do with some of the actions that were taken by Bishop Burke in La Crosse, Wisconsin, where he served before, and whether or not he will take the same actions here in St. Louis. And of course, it is big news when the outgoing bishop is named cardinal and given something of a promotion to another bishopric, and the incoming bishop is also one of the bright lights and shining stars of American Roman Catholicism. Raymond Burke will be talking about that with Helen Holt Hitchcock here for about 25 minutes. Pastor Will Wheaton joins us for the last half of this hour. We'll talk about an early church father, St. John Chrysostom. Helen Holt Hitchcock is a founding director of a group for Roman Catholic women called Women for Faith and Family. She's a regular guest here on Issues Etc. Helen, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You were able to attend the festivities surrounding the installation and the installation of Archbishop Raymond Burke. Tell us about that.
Well, it was the St. Louis Cathedral. If any of your listeners have failed to see the St. Louis Cathedral, they should repair that right away. It's quite a monument to, Western architecture. It's the one of the biggest in the country, and certainly one of the greatest examples of mosaic art in the country. The church was packed. The music was some of it was originally composed for this event, and it was very, very well performed. It was quite. There were two cardinals present, lots of bishops, and several hundred clergy, and it was hundreds and hundreds of laity. I don't know what the final count was, but the church was absolutely packed, and the crowd, the response of the congregation was overwhelmingly positive. I have not seen this before, but his homily was interrupted several times by applause, and that's something very unusual.
The newspaper article points out that one of the most sustained episodes of applause came after Archbishop Burke made mention of the protection of life, the sanctity of life, from conception to natural death. Fill in the details for us here, Helen. Why, this is, he could have made reference to a lot of things, and he did this here. This ties in with why he's been in the news so much lately.
That's true. He also got a lot of applause for when he spoke strongly in defense of the family and said that it was fundamental to society and that as the family goes, so goes the nation, quoting the Pope. And that was also, there was sustained applause for that, too. But you're right about that. And I think part of the reason is that, as probably most of your listeners know, St. Louis is a center of pro-life activity and was the focus of, almost the beginning of the pro-life activity among Catholics and Protestants as well, occurred in St. Louis right after the 1973 Supreme Court decision that permitted abortion. And so a lot of the, and also the Catholics in the crowd, probably many of them also read the newspapers and realize that this is an issue of controversy, and one on which the which Archbishop Burke has received criticism from various quarters, and so I think that the applause we heard and the sustained applause was not only would have issued anyway because of the convictions of the Catholic people who made up the congregation, but also in support of the bishop, and I think that that was a message lost on no one.
It's interesting, your description of the events of yesterday and the day before. There is also quoted in the Post-Dispatch, the leader of East Missouri's 14,000 Episcopalians, that would be Bishop G. Wayne Smith of the Episcopal Church USA, he said this, quote, "Burke really tried to persuade people with his moral teaching, but he will find that Missourians don't take kindly to being told what to think and what to do." How do you respond?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what the bishop meant by that, whether he meant that Missourians are uniquely resistant to persuasion, or whether he meant that Missourians don't listen to the truth when they hear it, or exactly how to take that. But as you know, the pro-life movement has wide and deep ecumenical dimensions. And the Episcopal Church has not been on the forefront of that, although there are pro-life groups within the Episcopal Communion. But the ecumenical allies in the pro-life movement have been, you know, as you probably know, very ecumenical. But what Archbishop Burke has said, and he issued a pastoral letter, actually, back in November, that didn't become public until he got in the news. But, I mean, it was published before, but it didn't really get much play before that. But he had said very strongly in that letter in November, this was before he was named bishop here, archbishop, I mean, he talked very strongly in that pastoral letter that he issued in the Diocese of La Crosse that Catholic politicians have the responsibility to work against an unjust law, even if the majority of the electorate support it. And he said that when Catholic politicians can't immediately overturn an unjust law, they must never cease to work toward that end. Now, that last sentence was a quote. And I think that that view of the responsibility of a Christian in a culture where which is not always altogether supportive of Christian moral teaching is shared by many, many believing Christians across denominational lines.
Then what are we to expect beyond the speculation that's been swirling in the papers about whether or not the La Crosse actions will be repeated here in St. Louis by Archbishop Burke? What are we to expect from this man? Your thoughts on this?
Well, he's a man of strong convictions, obviously, and for that, everyone, all Christians, can rejoice for that, I think, when what we hear from him is going to be honest and forthright. And clearly he's not, he knows the political penumbra around this issue. He's by no means naive about that, but he also is a man of conviction. On the other hand, I don't happen to know any high-profile Catholic politicians in the state who are militantly pro-abortion or pro-abortion at all. In fact, Missouri politicians have, and both parties, have taken some national lumps for being pro-life. So I'm not sure whether there would be an occasion for it, but I think that if there were an occasion, and if there were someone who were publicly proclaiming themselves to be both Catholic and pro-abortion, that he would have to do the same. He would be compelled, as their bishop, to address the issue in a similar way that he did in La Crosse. Any bishop would do that. Curiously, or not so curiously, perhaps, but some people have suggested, well, he's the only one who's doing this. That's not the whole picture by any means. A few weeks ago, the Archbishop of New Orleans issued a very strong pastoral letter, almost like the one that Archbishop Burke issued in La Crosse in November. And just a few days ago, several other bishops in the state of Wisconsin jointly issued a statement. Actually, it was authored by Bishop Morlino in Madison, but with the explicit approval of other bishops in Wisconsin, supporting Archbishop Burke down the line.
He certainly, at least initially, appears to be somewhat more high profile than Justin Regali was. And I noted to my wife when we were watching the news highlights last night, he was top story, of course, that he granted a face-to-face right there that evening, I think, at the reception with some of the press, which if you watched Archbishop Regali, now Cardinal Regali, throughout the last several years, he was more reticent to have contact with the press.
Well, I think that's probably true, but it's partly just their personality. And as far as Archbishop Regali's not having much advance press, he wasn't an archbishop in the United States, and he didn't have a diocese in the United States before he became Archbishop of St. Louis, and he'd spent nearly all of his career in Rome, where he was very high profile. So in a way, it's they're not quite interchangeable in their situation. Also, since Archbishop Regali had not been an ordinary of a diocese, that is, the bishop of a diocese in the United States, very few people really knew what he thought about anything. So there wasn't much advance press pro or con about Archbishop Regali. But I think it's true that that Bishop Burke means to speak out and speak with people. Last night I heard this. I didn't read it or hear, but someone told me that he actually, after the service and after the reception, he actually went to a fundraising thing at for a charitable organization in a downtown parish, just to stop in and say hello and thank you for coming and supporting this charity. Which and so I think he does intend to be. Some people call it pastoral bishop, one who reaches out to people and in a way that I think that St. Louisans of whatever Christian denomination will welcome.
Well, for my part, just a kind of a selfish way, I'm hoping that we'll actually get an interview with him, because it was difficult to get Regali, although we, at least in my tenure there, I think we talked with him at least once. Mm-hmm. Do we know anything about the relationship of Archbishop Burke to the Pope?
Well, Archbishop Burke served in Rome for some years, and was fairly well known in the Curia at that time. But as far as what his personal relationship has been with the Pope, I simply don't know.
There was an article in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch this weekend, Sunday's Metro section. St. Louis Archdiocese is characterized by active laity. What is the character here of the St. Louis Archdiocese that's being described?
Well, St. Louis, as you probably know, is historically a Catholic city founded by the French. It probably, when it was in colonial days, it was probably 100% Catholic. Then when it became, after the Louisiana Purchase, other people, American types, Yankees, in other words, came in too. But it was also, there was a large influx to St. Louis in the 1840s of Irish and Germans, many of whom, all the Irish, I suppose, and many of the Germans were also Catholic. And so it has, and as a sort of gateway to the West, it has been an outpost for the original diocese. It was the first diocese west of the Mississippi, and I believe St. Louis University may have been the first institution of higher learning west of the Mississippi. And so it has had that tradition of being Catholic. It isn't as high a percentage of Catholics now as it once was, obviously, but it has been a tradition, and there's a very high percentage of high number of per capita of Catholic schools. Catholic parishes traditionally have grammar schools, and there are a lot of Catholic high schools, and I think that is unusual in a major city. I mean, that's not that there aren't Catholic schools in other cities, but there's just a high percentage of people. I read a figure, I haven't seen it myself or seen the original study, but that a larger percentage of Catholic children are sent to Catholic schools than is characteristic in other cities. So there's that. So there's kind of a Catholic tradition here. But also, as far as activism is concerned, I think that the pro-life movement actually has been the focus of some of that. I think a lot of the lay groups that I know about that have formed, whether they're about Catholic sexual teaching or Catholic marriage and family life or catechetics and so on, a lot of the lay activity has been in support of Catholic teachings especially when they have seen it challenged. And as I said earlier, one of the first places where the pro-life movement really took hold and really got started was in St. Louis.
We're talking about the installation of St. Louis Archbishop Raymond Burke yesterday with Helen Hull Hitchcock, founding director of a group for Roman Catholic women called Women for Faith and Family. What are the major challenges then that face Archbishop Burke, beginning, I think, with the most obvious one, the one that's been the most press-worthy in the last several years, priestly sexual abuse, as he enters here into the St. Louis Archdiocese?
Well, that's not a burden solely for him. I think, as a matter of fact, in the studies that are coming out on that will reveal more, I suppose. But the Diocese of La Crosse was declared by this National Review Committee as being in conformity with the bishop's guidelines, and there's not clearly someone who stands so strongly with Catholic moral teaching is not singling out one issue. It's down the line. So what his policies, how he will implement those policies, of course, remains to be seen. But we can be sure that a man of conviction like Archbishop Burke will not brook fudging.
What about the issue of higher education? You had mentioned the number of educational institutions, St. Louis University, not least among them. Mm-hmm. The Pope has been pretty clear lately that he would like to see Roman Catholic educational institutions come more in line in terms of what is taught there with the teaching of the Church.
Right. Back in 1988, as a matter of fact, there was the statement on Catholic higher education called Ex Corde Ecclesiae, from the heart of the Church, meaning that the educational system was, this is where the heart of the Church is located, where the scholars, where the thinkers will be coming from. And that document has been, a lot of Catholic higher institutions, leaders of those Catholic higher institutions, had problems in the implications of that, meaning that they would have to take steps to make sure that they do not have in their theology departments people who are supposed to be teaching and forming young Catholics, teaching things that conflict with the Church. That has been a bone of contention among some people in the Catholic academic institutions. And one of the big contributions that the Pope has made to Catholic education is that back in 1994, I believe, the Catechism of the Catholic Church was released so that everyone has access to Catholic teaching. It's everyone who can buy a copy of the Catechism, so it no longer is in dispute. You don't have to be confused by what this theologian or that theologian may say. However, it's a problem that still needs much, much work, and it will be... it's always difficult for a bishop if he's got a lot of Catholic institutions of higher education under him, because, as you know, both Catholic and both religious and secular schools, the academic people generally tend to say that we have ultimate freedom and nobody can tell us what to teach. So how it will work out, I don't know. For the most part, I think he will have a great deal of support that he may not even realize he has within the Catholic institutions and among Catholic students, who are increasingly conscious of the fact that there's a conflict between the culture that they live in and the faith that they were taught as children. And this is going to be an interesting time to be alive and watch.
We started out talking about what Archbishop Burke called upon priests in the La Crosse diocese to do with regard to those who were pro-choice and Roman Catholic. If the occasion comes for Archbishop Burke to do the same here in St. Louis, do you believe that Roman Catholic priests in the parish will listen to Archbishop Burke, or has the spirit of congregational autonomy kind of become the rule in Roman Catholic parishes in St. Louis?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's become the rule, but I don't think that any church body in the United States has not been affected by a certain autonomous way of looking at things. You know, the "Don't Tread on Me" flag could be posted outside of a lot of churches I know, but I do think that it will be when he is able to enunciate. I imagine that he's going to have conversations with the leaders that of the Catholic schools, the Catholic institutions, and Catholic politicians as he needs to, and that may change some hearts, where instead of having just an automatic "leave me alone, the bishop doesn't have any authority here," I think that he may be able to persuade people that that a bishop does have authority and is a reliable source of authoritative information. And most Catholics in St. Louis, I think, would be eager to have someone explain those kinds of things to them, and it would be refreshing to many to hear it.
Helen Hull Hitchcock, we've got about 30 seconds here before we let you go. What do you think will be the biggest challenge for Bishop Burke?
I think probably for any bishop, overcoming any kind of prejudices against Catholic teaching that there are, and to persuade, it's always a difficulty, to persuade people to accept Catholic teaching on a wide range of issues that reach down to where we all live. You know, the very fundamental meaning of human life is one of the most core. And any bishop, any church leader would have a challenge to meet in our contemporary society.
Helen Hull Hitchcock, thank you for your time. Thanks for being our guest again on Issues Etc.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
Helen is founding director of a group for Roman Catholic women called Women for Faith and Family. Their website, if you'd like to visit it, wf-f.org. That's wf-f.org. St. John Chrysostom, when we come back from this break, an ancient church father, golden mouth, golden throat, obviously a preacher of some report. Pastor Will Whedon will join us, a golden throat in his own right, to talk about this ancient church father, his teaching, his necessity, the necessity for us to understand the unique insights of St. John Chrysostom when we come back from this break.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Have you noticed in many churches today, the God you find is convenient and non-confrontational, a sugar-sweet pushover of a God? What's happening when God seems to be against you, when God seems to be your problem, when God seems to be your enemy? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for January is called When God Becomes My Enemy. Through this in-depth study of the Old Testament complaint psalms, you'll discover the truth about God in the darkest of times. To order When God Becomes My Enemy, call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, When God Becomes My Enemy. When you call or write, mention Issues Etc., 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
Evolution, is it a barrier to the gospel? Answers with Ken Ham, one of the most in-demand Christian speakers in North America. Ken, I've heard some Christians say that by allowing evolution and billions of years of Earth history, non-Christian scientists are more likely to accept Christianity. But what do you think?
Well, from my experience, I believe the opposite's true. In fact, I've even seen non-Christian scientists lose their respect for Christians when they see them take evolution and add it to the Bible. You know, over 100 years ago, there was a very famous man called Thomas Huxley. He was an ardent humanist. Now, Huxley went around the world preaching evolution and putting down Christianity. But when he saw the theologians of the day accepting evolution, then adding it to the Bible, Huxley pointed out to these compromisers how inconsistent that was. He showed them that if they believed in evolution, they couldn't believe in the doctrines of the New Testament and would have to throw away the whole message of Christianity. You know what? Huxley seemed to understand Christianity better than these Christians. He saw clearly that the New Testament doctrines were based on Genesis and that evolution destroyed Christianity. How can Christians better witness to non-Christians? Well, by opposing evolution and defending Genesis and thus the whole Bible.
One of our best witnessing tools is Ken Ham's booklet on dinosaurs. You can find it on our website, answersradio.com. Print out a copy and share it with a non-Christian. It's free when you go to our attractive and easy-to-use website, answersradio.com.
Next time on the Bible study, we'll be in Nehemiah chapter 2, a chapter where Nehemiah requests and receives permission from King Artaxerxes to return to Jerusalem, and a chapter that describes Nehemiah's assessment of the broken-down walls in Jerusalem. Pastor Mark Hawkinson will be here to help us. The Bible Study, weekday mornings at 10:05. Next time, Nehemiah 2.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. How many ads do you think our children see on the internet, billboards, and TV? According to clinical psychologist Dr. Mary Pfeiffer, when it's all put together, our children see over 400 ads every day. She writes, quote, 400 ads a day create in children a combination of entitlement and dissatisfaction, end quote. Teach your children that contrary to what these ads would have us believe, the Bible teaches us that we are entitled to nothing except God's wrath and punishment because of our sin. Yet, we never need to be dissatisfied, because in spite of our sin, God still loves us for Jesus' sake, and He provides for all our needs. We deserve nothing, but in Christ, we receive everything. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at www.cmli.org.
Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for January, even as January dwindles down, when God becomes my enemy, the theology of the complaint psalms. Those are some of the most difficult passages of Scripture, especially for those of you out there who are all caught up in living that victorious Christian life. Just me and Jesus got a good thing going. You might find yourself ignoring Psalm 90, Psalm 74, Psalm 44. I think Psalm 88 is in there. They're called the complaint psalms for a reason. They're not only a bit of a conundrum for, well, everyone who reads them, because they depict God as absent, distant, wrathful, even God as an enemy. But the solution they also offer, these complaint psalms, has very little to do with somehow winning God's favor back through our works. In the end, the psalmist appeals to God's goodness, not his own. When God Becomes My Enemy is our Issues, Etc., book of the month for January, the theology of the complaint psalms. You can order the book, you can order it online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You'll find information there and a way to order. Also, you can call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. When you call or when you write, make sure you mention Issues, Etc. The book is called When God Becomes My Enemy. For the last 25 minutes of the program, Pastor Will Whedon joins us. He's pastor of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois. The subject for these last few minutes, an early church father, St. John Chrysostom. Pastor Whedon, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd. It's good to be with you today.
Well, I've received a number of emails from you in the course of, we've known each other for years now, but I notice at the end of your emails, you will often include kind of a rotating quote from an early church father or Luther or something like that. And I have noticed that St. John Chrysostom is often quoted. He seems to be one of your favorites. Why so?
Well, he is one of my favorites. I love the way he expresses things. He had a gift for words like few of us ever will. And in our Lutheran confessions, he is given significant play. I think it would be safe to say that maybe after St. Augustine and St. Ambrose, the most frequently quoted church father in the Lutheran confessions is St. John Chrysostom.
Tell us about the name. It's his name, of course, John, and then a bit of a nickname we've attached.
Right, right. His name Chrysostom means literally golden-mouthed, because he was such an incredibly fine orator and preacher. When he preached, he could, you know, he held the congregation in the palm of his hand, and he didn't abuse that gift. He used it for the sake of the gospel. He was a pretty fearless preacher. He denounced things that were sin and wrong, even though it offended people that were high in authority. And in the end, that ended up sending him into exile. In fact, today is celebrated as the day of St. John Chrysostom, not because this is the day that he died. He actually died on September 14th. But this is the day, 30 years after he died, that his bones were carried back to Constantinople. He died in exile because he had so angered the empress by his preaching.
Give us a bit of historical context on St. John Chrysostom. Where do we place him in church history?
Well, he is right there with the flowering of all of the great fathers of the 4th century. He was born in 347 in Syrian Antioch, which, of course, we know from the Bible is, you know, that place where they were first called Christians, the church that is so intimately associated with St. Paul, and who had other great saints not long after St. Paul. We think of Ignatius of Antioch, one of the really great fathers of the very early years of the church. So Antioch always produced an interesting variety of people who served the church, and John of Antioch was one in that long line. His gift of preaching there won so much fame that he was basically hijacked from Antioch, where he was perfectly happy to stay and serve, and made to assume the patriarchate, the archbishop throne, if you will, of the church in Constantinople, which the emperor had made the capital of the empire.
Now, we need to understand, of course, that Constantinople, obviously named after Emperor Constantine. We're talking about the days after Christianity is legalized in the Roman Empire.
Right.
And we're also talking about a time when Christianity is still predominantly, although of course not exclusively, an Eastern religion, an Eastern, geographically speaking, an Eastern religion, the capital of Christianity being in the East rather than, as it would be later, in the West, in Rome.
Yeah, the importance of Constantinople at the time would be hard to underestimate, although it was struggling in a way to achieve its greatness, because the ancient church clearly recognized the church at Alexandria, the church at Antioch, the church at Rome, the church at Jerusalem, because of its apostolic origin. But Constantinople was sort of a Johnny-come-lately to the patriarchates. But because it was the imperial city, it rose to fame very quickly and became the center of the Christianity that we know as Eastern Orthodoxy.
What was it? You mentioned that he was sent into exile. I don't want to jump immediately to the end of his life, but I'm curious, what was it that John Chrysostom was preaching that so angered the leaders of the day that they would send him away?
He was not, how do I put this? He angered a lot of people with his preaching, because his law preaching was such that he did not hesitate to step on any toes. And so if, you know, he castigated the pastors for the lousy lives they were living. He castigated the rich for the way they trampled upon the poor. He castigated those in power for not using their power to help the people who were suffering and disinherited from their, the rights of the dignity of human being. And he seemed not to hesitate to go after in very, the short answer to your question is he called the Empress a Jezebel, from the pulpit. And it wasn't, that's about all it took. You know, he equated the Empress with Queen Jezebel because of the way in which the people were fawning upon her. An image of her had been unveiled, and the people had been, just raving about the beauty of this image. And he's like, it's just, an image to Jezebel.
How would you characterize the theology of St. John Chrysostom?
He was a very pastoral theologian. He was not a deep thinker in the way of some of the other Orthodox fathers. That's not the way to put it. He was not an original thinker. He didn't try to push the boundaries. He simply was concerned to hand on the faith as it had been given to him, and to do it with the best flair, if I can put it that way, in presentation that he could give it. And that earned him a great reputation. Our own Martin Chemnitz spoke highly of John Chrysostom. Can I just read a little section where he evaluates him?
Sure.
Chemnitz writes, "Chrysostom was a man of great eloquence. He produced commentaries on Genesis, Matthew, John, and all the Pauline epistles. These were so well regarded by posterity that Theophylact has abbreviated them into a compendium with the sermonic portions cut off. Even to this day, they are read and approved by all. He also wrote many homilies, the reading of which can instruct the studious." He goes on to note that John did have a weakness, and that was a weakness of all orators, that he sometimes would express himself a little too inexactly to make a point, and therefore he sometimes could be heard to be saying things that he himself didn't want to say. He got into a little bit of trouble with the Pelagian controversy with St. Augustine. St. Augustine defended him by saying, he didn't mean to say the way he said what he said.
So, in other words, we're talking about a genuine human being, no plaster saint here.
No plaster saint. Oh, absolutely not. He was a short little guy. He was about 5 foot tall. There is a quote that I really like about him that says, "The slight 5 foot tall St. John stood tall in his defiance of state authority, bowing only to God and never yielding his high principles of Christianity to expediency or to his personal welfare." And that way he was a great man.
You mentioned that the Lutheran confessions make use of him second only to Ambrose and Augustine as church fathers. The Lutheran confessions, of course, being the foundational documents at the time of the Reformation that articulate what it is Reformation theology and scriptural teaching on the most important matters of the faith are. To what end do they quote St. John Chrysostom?
Well, when they quote St. John Chrysostom, the most famous quote they provide from him is found in the Solid Declaration of the Formula of Concord. And he said so well that all the other church fathers after him just started quoting him. And our Lutheran confessions do the same thing. Can I read the little quote here?
Please do.
It's a wonderful, wonderful word. Speaking about the Lord's Supper, he writes, "Christ prepares this table himself and blesses it. No human being makes the bread and wine which are set before us the body and blood of Christ. Rather, Christ himself, who is crucified for us, does that. The words are spoken by the mouth of the priest. But when he says, 'This is my body,' the elements that have been presented in the supper are consecrated by God's power and grace through the word. Just as the saying, 'Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth,' was said only once, and yet it continually is effective in nature, causing it to grow and multiply. So these words were said once, but they are powerful and do their work in our day and until his return, so that in the supper as celebrated in the church, his true body and blood are present." Isn't that beautiful?
And very simple.
Very simple.
I've read the Church Fathers on the Lord's Supper and on the words of institution and those sections of Scripture, and it was often more philosophical treatments.
Right.
But also less easy to understand.
Right. Can I give you another one from John Chrysostom before we run out of time that I really, really love?
That's what the time's for here, Will.
Okay.
Go ahead.
This is actually, I'm going to read you a sermon, believe it or not. Don't worry, it's short, okay? This is read in the Orthodox Church every Easter, and our own Commission on Worship published it a few years ago to be used in our Lutheran churches, too, for any who desired it. It was one of those classic instances where St. John Chrysostom said something so well that it's simply hard to improve upon. Let me share it. Let all the pious and lovers of God rejoice in the splendor of this feast. Let the wise servants blissfully enter into the joy of their Lord. Let those who have borne the burden of Lent now receive their pay. And those who have toiled since the first hour, let them now receive their due reward. Let any who came after the third hour be grateful to join in the feast. And those who may have come after the sixth, let them not be afraid of being too late. For the Lord is gracious. He receives the last even as the first. He gives rest to those who come on the 11th hour as well as those who have toiled since the first. Yes, he has pity on the last and he serves the first. He rewards the one and is generous to the other. He repays the deed and praises the effort. Come, you all! Enter into the joy of your Lord. You the first and you the last, receive alike your reward. You rich and you poor, dance together. You sober and you weaklings, celebrate the day. You who have kept the fast and you who have not, rejoice today. The table is richly loaded. Enjoy its royal banquet. The calf is a fatted one. Let no one go away hungry. All of you, enjoy the banquet of faith. All of you, receive the riches of his goodness. Let none grieve over their poverty, for the universal kingdom has been revealed. Let none weep over their sins, for pardon has shone forth from the grave. Let none fear death, for the death of our Savior has set us free. He's destroyed it by enduring it. He's despoiled Hades by going down into its kingdom. He angered it by allowing it to taste of his flesh. Oh, when Isaiah saw this, he cried out, Hades, you have been angered by encountering him in the netherworld. Hades is angered because frustrated. It is angered because it has been mocked. It is angered because it has been destroyed. It's angered because it has been reduced to nothing. It's angered because it is now captive. It seized a body. And lo, it discovered God. It seized earth, and behold, it encountered heaven. It seized the visible and was overcome by the invisible. Oh, death, where is your sting? Oh, Hades, where is your victory? Christ is risen and you are abolished. Christ is risen and the demons are cast down. Christ is risen and the angels rejoice. Christ is risen and life is freed. Christ is risen and the tomb is emptied of the dead. For Christ, being raised from the dead, has become the reviver and leader of those who have fallen asleep. To him be glory and power forever and ever. Amen. Is that awesome?
That would suffice as far as I'm concerned, if I could hear that every Easter. It's not bad to hear every Sunday, in fact.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just such a short message, but wow, does he pack it in there.
We're talking about the 4th century church father, St. John Chrysostom. Pastor Will Wheadon is our guest. He's pastor of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, feel free to do so. We have about 10 minutes left, just a little less than that. 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. St. John Chrysostom is often quoted by the Eastern Church, and I've noticed a large number of Orthodox churches bear his name as well.
Yes, he's very popular with the Eastern Church, not merely because he was such a famous preacher and so beloved for the things that he wrote, but especially because there is a divine service, an order of the liturgy, which bears his name and which many liturgical scholars do believe can be traced directly back to St. John himself. And that is actually the normal order of worship which an Eastern Orthodox Christian uses on a given Lord's Day. A kind of interesting twist on that is our sister church in the Ukraine, the Ukrainian Lutheran Church, is formed of indigenous Ukrainian people, and they were Ukrainian Orthodox people who became convinced of the truth of the Lutheran confessions and became Lutheran Christians, but they continue to worship according to the liturgy of St. John Chrysostom. If our people were to go and worship with them, we would find their worship to be very strange. But they basically follow this very ancient and beautiful liturgy from the hand of St. John.
On that very subject, we have Harold calling from St. Charles on the line. Harold, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you to elaborate a little bit on St. John Chrysostom's role in the liturgy. Like today, I picked up a fine CD. I haven't had a chance to listen to it, but by a Russian composer, Alexander Nikolsky. I know Tchaikovsky and Rachmaninoff and a number of others have based some Orthodox liturgy things on St. John's liturgy. And they're very, very great. In fact, I've passed some of these CDs on that I buy there to Professor Kurt Marquardt, you know, who's got an interesting Russian background. Another thing is, too, about him, it was at St. John Chrysostom that he was such a great orator as a speaker that he would be interrupted, and people would clap and cheer, and he had to try to restrain them. And they ignored him more or less, or that was at another early church father.
Thank you, Harold, for both the comment and the question. Why don't we answer the question first here?
Yeah, no, that you're absolutely right, Harold. It was St. John Chrysostom, and in fact, in his wonderful little treatise on the priesthood, he speaks specifically about this, about, you know, people, we don't preach for applause, but literally that was the culture at Constantinople. The people would in the middle of the sermon, break into applause at the way he said things. And he finally basically put the kibosh on that and said, you know, that is no place in the liturgy. And after John Chrysostom, it pretty much stopped.
And then as to the, you said that if we were to observe fellow Christians following the liturgy that is traced back to Chrysostom,
mm-hmm.
We would find it somewhat strange. Very briefly, what would be strange about it?
Well, characteristic of the Eastern liturgy is it's not in a hurry to go anywhere. In Western liturgy, we are very ordered, and we move things along one point after another in logical procession. The whole liturgy hangs together, makes sense, and moves from point to point. In the East, you get the feeling that time doesn't matter so much. And in the liturgy of St. John Chrysostom, my friends and I always joke about it, we call it the again and again liturgy. Because literally in the liturgy, you hear the deacon call out, again and again in peace, let us pray to the Lord, Lord have mercy. Now actually, that is a piece of Eastern liturgy, which many Lutherans have become very familiar with. In our service, the Kyrie that has the form, in peace, let us pray to the Lord, Lord have mercy, for the peace from above and for our salvation, let us pray to the Lord, Lord have mercy. That is from the liturgy of St. John Chrysostom.
So we wouldn't be so very unfamiliar with it.
No, with that we would not. When I was speaking of things we would be a little bit unfamiliar with, maybe would be the use of the icons and of incense in the service. They are... It's a different. You definitely step into a different world when you worship according to that liturgy. But if you take away the, you know, if you look underneath the smoke of the incense and you study the basic form, you realize the liturgy of St. John Chrysostom is simply a variation on the historic liturgy of the Church. That the East, the Eastern liturgy there and the Western liturgy are very closely related, and it's not very hard to see the same basic pattern run through them.
You mentioned before Chemnitz, and Chemnitz seemed to be aware of a rather large number of extant writings from St. John Chrysostom. Is there a lot of the person were want to do some reading in St. John Chrysostom that they could find?
Yeah, in fact, there are two books that I would heartily recommend as being outstanding. If you're a pastor and you're listening, I would suggest that a reading of St. John's six books on the priesthood would be well worthwhile. They're really wonderful. It can be had from St. Vladimir's Seminary Press. And also, they've collected a number of John's sermons on marriage and family life, and they are outstanding for anyone that wants to dig a little deeper into what the biblical message is for a marriage, for what the family is all to be about. These sermons are just fabulous, and it's the little volumes called On Marriage and Family Life. In addition, the Schaff collection of the Nicene and Post-Nicene Fathers has huge sections devoted to Chrysostom's commentaries, which Chemnitz said are worthwhile, and they really are. The things that he comes up with are always interesting. Even if you don't always agree with where he's coming from, you will find yourself being really provoked by what he says there. He makes you think.
Finally, with about 2 minutes here, what could the Church of today, in the early 21st century, the Christians of today, what could we learn from the writings, the thought, the work of St. John Chrysostom from the 4th century?
I think the biggest thing we need to relearn from St. John is not to be afraid of the message and proclaiming it, I mean, keeping it straight, getting it out, proclaiming that message, and not caring one little bit what it costs. You know what? If we proclaim the message straight and pure, we may suffer. John suffered for it, sent into exile for proclaiming the word, and yet he refused to compromise. He called sin a sin, and he wouldn't back down. And no one could, well, you heard the Easter sermon. I mean, no one can preach grace more powerfully than him either. I do have to say, a lot of our pastors have a very unfortunate thought about St. John Chrysostom planted in them from C.F.W. Walther, bless his heart. In his proper distinction between law and gospel, he speaks against Chrysostom as not properly distinguishing law and gospel. I can only think the excuse must be he's going by hearsay and he hasn't read the man's sermons. Because if you read Chrysostom's sermons, they are stunning examples of full-blast law and sweet gospel consolation. You know, he does a great job of rightly dividing. And if we in our day could have the courage and boldness of a St. John to proclaim the with the law in its full severity and the gospel in its full sweetness, we may be a suffering church, but we would be a church that would be blessed.
And to the pastor or the Christian out there who says, all well and good for St. John Chrysostom, obviously blessed by God with the gift of oratory and the ability to earn a name like Golden Mouthed, but I'm not that orator. Your best piece of advice?
Well, would be to pick up his book on the priesthood and read it, because he deals with that right in there. And in fact, let me give you my last quote.
You got 1 minute.
Hold on, I'm grabbing the phone here. You still there?
I'm still here.
Okay, my last quote from St. John Chrysostom I grabbed the wrong book. 1 second. I just absolutely love this. And will I be able to find it? I have it underlined. That doesn't mean that I will be able to find it right away here. He's speaking about...
And you're down to 1 minute, Will.
Uh-oh. I might have to paraphrase.
Go ahead and paraphrase.
Okay, let me give a paraphrase. He says, let a man be ever so beggarly in his diction and in his oratory, but let him state the doctrine precisely. I love that quote. He says, don't worry. He says, don't worry first and foremost about getting it, making it sound beautiful. Get the message straight.
Pastor Will Wheaton, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you. It's a blessing, Todd.
Pastor Will Wheaton, pastor of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois. We were talking about the early church father remembered this day in the church, St. John Chrysostom. Tomorrow on the program, a religion roundup with our good friend Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International. Looking forward to that and talking with you again. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.